Selected Shorts is supported in part by the loyal friends of Selected Shorts. To join, or for more information, visit selectedshorts.org.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
To the Countess Dies, it seemed that all the wealth and beauty of the city had flocked to the ballroom which they entered together. Under the flare of crystal chandeliers, fashion danced in the arms of affluence. Everywhere jewels sparkled, eyes laughed back at lips that smiled. Perfumes were like the scents of Araby on a hot desert breeze. Conversation blended with the swinging lilt of the orchestra on the balcony. The shuffle of feet and the whisper of silks and satins filled the room with a queer dissonance.
You're listening to the incomparable Fionnuala Flanagan reading from a mystery story by C.S. Montaigne and entitled A Shock for the Countess, one of the two stories on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Women on a Mission. That's the theme of this program's two short stories, both read on our annual visits to the Getty Center in Los Angeles, California. The first story, about jewel thievery, is Carlton Stevens Montaigne's A Shock for the Countess, and it's read for us by Fionnuala Flanagan.
From the terraces of the Chateau d'Is, the valley of Var was spread out below Gatière, threaded with the broad bed of the river Var, swirling over its stony reaches from its cradle in the Haute Alpe. The snow-crowned mountains frowned ominously down, but in the valley summertime warmth prevailed, quietude disturbed only by the song of birds and the voice of the river. On the shaded promenade of the chateau, the pretty Comtesse d'Is stared thoughtfully at the unwinding river of the dust-powdered highway twisting off into the dim distance. Beside her, a tall, well-built young man in tweeds absently flicked the ash from his cigarette and tinkled the ice in the thin glass he held. Once or twice he surreptitiously considered the woman who reclined so indolently in the padded depths of a black wicker chair. The Countess seemed rarely lovely on this warm, lazy afternoon. Her ash-blonde hair caught what sunshine came in under the sand-colored awning above. Her blue eyes were dreamy and introspective, her red lips meditatively pursed. Yet, for all of her abstraction, there was something regal and almost imperious in her bearing, a subtle charm and distinction that was entirely her own. "I do believe," the Countess remarked at length, "we are about to entertain visitors." She motioned casually with a white hand toward the dust-filled road. The man beside her leaned a little forward. A mile or less distant, he observed an approaching motor car that crawled up the road between clouds of dust. "Visitors?" The Countess inclined her head. "So it would appear. And visitors, mon ami, who have come a long way to see us. Observe that the machine is travel-stained, that it appears to be weighted down with luggage." "Possibly it is our old friend Mourget," she added almost mischievously. The face of the man in tweeds paled under its tan. "Mourget," he exclaimed under his breath. The Countess smiled faintly. "Oh, but it is probably only a motoring party up from Georges de Loup who have wandered off the main road, Armand." The man in tweeds had torn the cigarette between his fingers into rags. As if held in the spell of some strange fascination, he watched the motor grow larger and larger. "There are men in it," he muttered, when the dusty car was abreast the lower wall of the chateau. "Four men." The woman in the wicker chair seemed suddenly to grow animated. "Mon Dieu," she said in a low voice. If it is he, that devil. The man she addressed made no reply, only the weaving of his fingers betraying his suppressed nervousness. The hum of the sturdy motor was heard from the drive way among the terraces now. There was an interlude, voices around a bend in the promenade, finally the appearance of a liveried automaton that was the butler.
Monsieur Mourgier, madame.
The man in tweed stifled a groan. The Comtesse turned slowly in her chair. You may direct Monsieur Mourgier here, Henri. The butler bowed and turned away. The man in tweeds clasped his hands until the nails of them bit into the palms.
God!
The Comtesse laid a tense hand on his arm. Smile, she commanded. The Monsieur Mourgier, who presently sauntered down the shaded promenade of the chateau, was a tall, loose-jointed individual with a melancholy moustache and a deeply wrinkled face. A shabby, dusty suit hung loosely and voluminously about his spare figure. A soft straw hat was in one hand. He was grey at the temples. When he bowed over the slender fingers of the Comtesse, there was a hidden glow in his sombre eyes. To be favoured by the presence of the great, the woman murmured softly. Monsieur, this is an honour. May I make you acquainted with the Marquis de Remec? She introduced the visitor to the man in tweeds, who bowed stiffly. Somewhere back around the corner of the promenade, the drone of the voices of those who had been in the car sounded faintly. A liqueur, monsieur? The Comtesse asked. A cigar. A visitor shook his head, gazed on the peaceful panorama of the valley of the Var.
Thank you, no. My time is limited. My journey has been a long one, and I must make a start for Paris with all due haste. You, he explained courteously, and the Marquis will put yourselves in readiness with as much rapidity as possible. You are both my guests for the return journey.
The man in tweeds whitened to the lips. His startled glance darted to the Comtesse. The woman had settled herself back in the black wicker chair again and had joined her fingers tip to tip. Accompany you to Paris? She drawled. Are you quite serious? The wrinkled face of Monsieur Mourgier grew inflexible, brass-like.
Quite serious, he replied. You are both under arrest for the theft of the de Valois pearls.
For a week, intermittently, Paris had known rain, the cold, chilly drizzle of early springtime. Because of the weather, cafes and theatres were crowded, fiacres and taxis in constant demand, omnibuses jammed, and the drenched boulevards deserted by their usual loungers. From Montmartre to Montparnasse, scudding grey clouds veiled the reluctant face of the sun by day and hid a knife-edged moon by night. The steady, monotonous drizzle pattered against the boudoir windows in the house of the Comtesse d'Is, midway down the street of the first shell. Within, all was snug, warm and comfortable. A coal fire burned in a filigree basket grate. The radiance of a deeply shaded floor lamp near the toilette table, where a small maid hovered like a mother pigeon about the Comtesse, diffused a subdued, mellow glow. The evening growl of Paris came as if from far away, a lesser sound in the symphony of the rain.
Madame will wear her jewels?
The Comtesse turned and lifted her blue eyes.
My rings only, Marie, if you please.
The maid brought the jewel casket, laid it beside her mistress, and at the wardrobe selected a luxurious Kolinsky cape, which she draped over an arm. The Comtesse slipped on her rings one by one, flashing blue-white diamonds in carved platinum settings, an odd Egyptian temple ring, a single ruby that burned like a small ball of crimson fire. When the last ring glinted on her white fingers, she dropped the lid of the casket, stood, and turned to a full-length cheval mirror back of her. The glass reflected the full perfection of her charms, the sheer wonder of her sequin-spangled evening gown, the creamy luster of her bare, powdered arms, shoulders, and rounded contralto throat. Standing there, the soft light on her hair, she was radiant, incomparable, a reincarnated Diana, whose draperies came from the most expert needles of the Rue de la Paix. "I think," the Comtesse said aloud, "those who go to fashionable affairs to witness and copy will have much to occupy their pencils on the morrow. My gown is clever, is it not, Marie?"
"It is beautiful," the maid breathed.
With a little laugh, the Comtesse took the Kolinsky cape. "Now, I must hasten below to the Marquis. Poor boy, it is an hour or more that I have kept him cooling his heels. Oh, Marie, suspense, they say, breeds appreciation, but there is such a thing as wearing out the patience of a cavalier. The really intelligent woman knows when not to overdo it. You understand?"
"Oh, perfectly, madame," the maid replied.
The Comtesse let herself out and sought the stairs. She moved lightly down steps that were made mute by the weight of their waterfall of gorgeous carpet. Murals looked down upon her progress to the lower floor. Tapestries glittered with threads of flame. The very air seemed somnolent with the heaviness of sybaritic luxury. Humming a snatch of a boulevard chansonnette, the Comtesse turned into a lounge room that was to the right of the entry hall below. The aroma of cigarette smoke drifted to her. When she crossed the threshold, the Marquis de Remec stood, a well-made, immaculately groomed individual in his perfectly tailored evening clothes.
"Forgive me, Armand," the Comtesse pleaded. "Mary was so stupid tonight, all thumbs. I thought she would never finish with me."
The Marquis lifted her fingers to his lips.
"How lovely you are," he cried softly. "Ah, dear one, will you never say the word that will make me the happiest man in all France? For 2 years we have worked together shoulder to shoulder, side by side. For 2 years you have been a star to me, earthbound, beautiful beyond all words. 2 years of," the Comtesse interrupted with a sigh,
"of thrills and danger, Armand, of plots and stratagems, plunder and wealth. I think, mon ami," she said seriously, "if we are successful tonight, I will marry you before April ends. But wait, understand me. It will be a secret. I will still be the Comtesse d'Is, and you will remain the Marquis de Remec to all the world but me. Then, my friend, if either of us suffers disaster, one will not drag the other down. You see?" She seated herself beside the Marquis, considering him wistfully.
"But tonight," he said in a stifled voice, "the de Valois affair is the hardest nut we have yet attempted to crack. Tonight we will need all of our cunning, all of our wits."
The Comtesse lifted airy eyebrows.
"Indeed?"
The Marquis leaned closer to her. "There is not," he explained rapidly, "only Monsieur Murger of the Sûreté to consider, the knowledge that he has been blundering after us for months, but the wolf as well. An hour ago only, François picked up some gossip across the river in some dive. The wolf steals from his lair tonight, questing the Devalois pearls. Do you understand? We must face double enemies. The net of Mourgier, the fangs of the animal who sulks among the Apache brigands of the riverfront. And this is the task you give, to set a crown upon my every hope.
The Comtesse d'Ys touched his hand with her pretty fingers. Does the threat of Mourgier and the presence of the wolf pack dismay you? She questioned lightly. You, the undaunted, you who have been the hero of so many breathless adventures. Armand, you annoy me.
Derimek stood.
But this is different, he cried. Here I have something at stake more precious than gold or jewels. Your promise. I tremble.
Comtesse laughed at his melodrama. Silly boy. We shall not fail. We will snatch the famous pearls from under the very noses of those who would thwart and destroy us.
Voila!
I snap my fingers at them all. Come now, it grows late. Had we not better start? The other glanced at his watch.
Yes, François is waiting with the limousine. When they were side by side in the tonneau of the purring motor, the Comtesse glanced at the streaming windows and shivered. Oh, soon it will be late spring, she said quietly. Soon it will be our privilege to rest city-weary eyes on the valley of the Var. I intend to open the chateau in 6 weeks, mon ami. It will seem like heaven, after the miserable winter and the rain. Oh, the rain. The car shaped a course west, then south. Paris lifted a gaudy reflection to the canopy of the frowning clouds, flashing past in its nightly pursuit of pleasure. The Comtesse eyed the traffic tide idly. Her thoughts were like skeins of silk on a loom that was slowly being reversed. She thought of yesterday, of the little heap of jewels in the boudoir of the villa at Trouville that had been the scene of that weekend party, of herself stealing through the gloom to purloin them, of the Marquis bound on the same errand, of their meeting. Surprise! Their pact! And the bold, triumphant exploits they had both planned and carried out. The red lips of the Comtesse were haunted by a smile. It had all been so easy, so exciting, so simple. True, the dreaded Mourgier of the law had pursued them relentlessly, but they had always outwitted him, had always laughed secretly at his discomfiture, rejoicing together over their spoils. Now, tonight, it was the Devalois pearls, that famous coil the woman had had strung in Amsterdam by experts. Tomorrow, Madame Devalois would be bewailing its loss, and the necklace would be speeding to some foreign port, safe in the possession of the agent who handled all their financial transactions. The wolf, the Countess thought. Oh, surely there was nothing to fear from the hulk of the Apache outlaw, a man whose cleverness lay in the curve of a knife, the slippery rope of the garrote, the sandbag of the desperado. How could the wolf achieve something that required brains, delicate finesse? It was only the chance that Mourgier might upturn some carefully hidden clue that was perilous.
You are silent, the Marquis observed.
I am thinking, the Countess d'Ys replied dreamily. A dozen more streets and the motor was in the Rue de la Sainte Vigne, stopping before a striped canopy that stretched from the door to the curb that fronted the Paris home of Madame de Valois. The windows of the building were brightly painted with light. The whisper of music crept out. Set in the little unlighted park that surrounded it, the house was like a painted piece of scenery on a stage. A footman laid a gloved hand on the silver knob of the limousine door and opened it. The Marquis de Ramec assisted the Comtesse to alight. Safe from the rain under the protection of the awning, they went up the front steps and entered the house.
"You," the Comtesse instructed cautiously, "watch for Mougier, and I will take care of the wolf whelps. If the unexpected transpires, we will meet tomorrow at noon in the basement of the Café of the Three Friends. François has been instructed. He will keep the motor running around the corner," the Marquis whispered. Then, pressing her hand, "courage, dear one, and a prayer for success." To the Countess Dies, it seemed that all the wealth and beauty of the city had flocked to the ballroom, which they entered together. Under the flare of crystal chandeliers, fashion danced in the arms of affluence. Everywhere jewels sparkled, eyes laughed back at lips that smiled. Perfumes were like the scents of Araby on a hot desert breeze. Conversation blended with the swinging lilt of the orchestra on the balcony. The shuffle of feet and the whisper of silks and satins filled the room with a queer dissonance. Separating from the Marquis, the Countess, greeting those who addressed her with a friendly word, a smile or bow, promptly lost herself in the crush. Mougier's assistance she left to the attention of de Ramec. She decided first to mark the presence of Madame de Valois and the pearls. After that, she would seek the wolf or his agents in the throng. After some manoeuvring, the Countess discovered the location of Madame de Valois. The woman was dancing with a grey-bearded senator. An ample, overdressed burden from whose fat neck the famous rope of pearls swayed with every step. The Countess watched the woman drift past and then turned to seek the footprints of the wolf. In and out among the crowd she circulated, disregarding those she knew, scanning anxiously the faces and appearances of those she had never before seen. An hour sped past before she believed she had at last discovered the man she sought. This was a beardless youth in shabby evening attire who lingered alone in a foyer that adjoined the south end of the ballroom. Watching, the Countess touched the elbow of a woman she knew, discreetly indicated the youth, and asked a question. "That," her friend replied, "is a Monsieur Fernier. He is a young composer of music from the Latin Quarter. Madame de Valois invited him tonight so that he might hear the orchestra play one of his own dance compositions. He is so melancholy, don't you think?" "From the Latin Quarter," the Countess told herself when she was alone again. "I will continue to watch you, Monsieur Fernier." A few minutes later, the Marquis de Ramec approached. "Three agents of Mougier present," he breathed, drifting past. "The doors are guarded. Be cautious, dear one." Another 60 minutes passed. It was midnight precisely when the Countess saw the putative student from the Latin Quarter make his first move. The youth took a note from his pocket and handed it to a footman with a word of instruction. The servant threaded away among the crowd and delivered the message to Madame de Valois. The woman excused herself to those about her, opened the note, read it, and after several more minutes began to move slowly toward the ballroom doors. Countess, tingling, tightened her lips. A glance over her shoulder showed her that Fernier had left the foyer. What was the game? A minute or two after Madame de Valois had disappeared through the doors of the ballroom, the Countess had reached them. She looked out in time to behold the other woman crossing the entry hall and disappearing through the portiere of the reception room beyond. There was no one in evidence.
Certain she was on the right trail and filled with a growing anticipation, the Countess waited until the portiere opposite ceased to flutter before moving swiftly toward them. The metallic jar of bolts being drawn, a scraping sound, and then a damp, cool current of air told the Countess that without question the long French windows in the reception room opening out on a balcony that overlooked one side of the park had been pushed wide. She parted the portiere cautiously and looked between them. The chamber was in darkness. Madame de Valois was a bulky silhouette on the balcony outside. Voices mingled faintly. On noiseless feet, the Countess picked a stealthy way down the room. Close to the open windows, she drew back into a nest of shadows, leaned a little forward and strained her ears. There came to her the perplexed query of Madame de Valois.
"But why do you ask me to come out here? Who are you? What is the secret you mention in your note?"
A pause. The suave, silky tones of a man.
"A thousand pardons, madame. This was the only way possible under the circumstance. My secret is a warning. Unscrupulous people are within who would prey upon you."
"You mean..."
Madame de Valois stammered.
"I mean," the man replied, "your pearls."
Another pause, plainly one of agitation for the woman on the balcony. Then the man again.
"Madame, allow me to introduce myself. Possibly you have heard of me. Paris knows me as the Wolf. Madame will kindly make neither outcry nor move. My revolver covers you steadily, and my finger is on the trigger.
I will take care of your pearls and see that no one takes them. Madame will be so kind as to remove the necklace immediately."
Madame de Valois' gasp of dismay followed hard on the heels of a throaty chuckle.
Came unexplainable sounds, the words,
"Thank you. Adieu."
Then the woman tottering in through the open windows, a quivering mountain of disconcerted flesh making strange, whimpering sounds. Madame de Valois had hardly reached the middle of the reception room before the Countess was out on the balcony and was over its rail. A single glance showed her the shadowy figure of the Wolf hastening toward the gates at the far end of the park that opened on the avenue beyond. With all the speed at her command, the Countess ran to the other door in the street wall that was to the right of the house. The door was unlocked. She flung it open and surged out onto the wet pavement, heading toward the avenue, running with all speed, while her fingers found and gripped the tiny revolver she had hidden under the overskirt of her evening creation. She reached the gates at the northern end of the park. At the same minute, footsteps sounded on the other side of them. They gave slowly, allowing a stout, bearded man to pass between them. The Countess drew back and waited until he turned to close the gates after him. Then she took two steps forward and sank the muzzle of her weapon into the small of his back.
"Do not trouble yourself to move, Monsieur Wolf," she said sweetly. "Just keep facing the way you are, and I will help myself to the pearls without bothering you." She could feel the quiver of the man's back under the nose of the gun.
"You will die for this," the Wolf vowed.
The Countess found the smooth, lustrous coil of Madame de Valois' necklace in his side pocket and stuffed it hastily into her bodice.
"Possibly," she agreed amiably. "But this is no time to discuss the question. Pay attention to what I say. If you move before 2 minutes elapse, I will shoot you down in your tracks. Continue to keep your face glued to the gates and..."
Dropping her weaponed hand, the Countess surged around the turn of the wall where the avenue joined the side street and raced across the petrol-polished asphalt toward François and the waiting limousine. Hazily aware of the growing tumult in the house itself, the Countess was stunned by the sudden crack of a revolver, the whistle of a bullet flying past her, the hoarse bellow of the Wolf's voice.
"Police! Police! Thieves! There she goes, in that car!"
pausing only to fire twice at the howling Apache, the Countess, sensitive to the fact that a machine was rolling down the street toward her, climbed into the limousine. "Quick!" she cried breathlessly. "Off with you, Francois!" Like a nervous thoroughbred, the car sprang toward the junction of the avenue beyond. The Countess pressed her face to the rear window. The other motor was 1,000 rods behind, a car with pale yellow lamps, a police car, one of the machines of the Sûreté. "Across the river," the Countess directed through the open front glass of the limousine. "We will shake them off on the other side of the Seine." Across a bridge, over the night-painted river, past cafes, and then into a district of gaunt, silent warehouses, the limousine panted. Twice more the Countess looked back. The pale yellow lamps behind followed like an avenging nemesis. "Round the next corner and slow down," the Countess commanded crisply. "The minute I swing off, speed up and head for the open country." On two wheels, the limousine shot around into the black gully of a narrow, cobble-paved side street. Its brakes screamed as it slowed for a minute before lunging forward again. Shrinking back behind a pile of casks that fronted one of the warehouses, the Countess laughed as the second car whirled past. "Oh, the long arm of Mouger," she sneered. "What rubbish!" Still laughing a little, she moved out from behind the casks to stiffen suddenly and dart back again behind them. A motorcycle had wheeled into the silent street and a man was jumping off it. The Countess, frantic fingers clutching the pearls of Madame de Valois, knew it was the wolf even before his level tones came to her.
"Mademoiselle," the Apache said, "I know you are there. I saw the shimmer of your gown before you stepped back behind those casks. You cannot escape me. Hand the necklace over."
"The theft of the de Valois pearls?" the Countess Dix cried softly. "Monsieur is joking."
Mouger, on the shaded promenade of the chateau, touched the tips of his disconsolate moustache. "There is really," he said almost wearily, "no use in pretending surprise or indignation. 4 days ago, we bagged the wolf. He made a full and complete confession."
The sunlit quiet of the promenade was broken by the throaty cry of the Countess Dix. She jumped up, her blue eyes cold, blazing stars. "Yes, you devil," she said unsteadily. "Yes, Monsieur Ferré, we took the pearls. I took the pearls. The wolf did not get them. No one else shall. I have hidden them well. Take me, take us both. Jail us. You will never find the necklace. No one ever will."
Mouger snapped his fingers twice.
The men who had come up the dusty road in the travel-stained motor rounded the corner of the walk. The Countess laughed insolently at the man who faced her.
"In a measure," Mouger said quietly, "your statement is true. No one will ever redeem the de Valois pearls. Let me tell you something. When the wolf made his appearance that night at the warehouse, you saved the necklace from him by dropping it into the mouth of an open cask. Is that not correct? You marked this cask so you might distinguish it again. When you foiled the wolf, your agent began a search for the cask. It had been stored away in the warehouse. There were difficulties. So far, your aide has not been able to locate it. But you have hopes." "Madame Countess, it is my duty to disillusion both you and," he nodded towards the Remec, "your husband. There was one thing you overlooked.
the contents of the cask in question.
The Comtesse drew a quick breath, leaning forward as if to read the meaning of the other's words.
The contents?
Mougier smiled.
The cask, he explained, we found to be half full of vinegar.
The pearls are no more.
Eaten up like that. Poof! Let us be going.
Fionnuala Flanagan read C.S. Montaigne's A Shock for the Countess. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our next writer, Mark Helprin, is the author of the wondrous novel Winter's Tale. The heroine of Helprin's story, Catherine Comes to Yellow Sky, travels from England to the wild American West on a quest to find her true self in a vision of clouds and yellow sky. The reader is Lisa Gay Hamilton.
Like a French balloonist, who rides above in the clear silence, slowly turning in his wicker basket, Catherine rode rapidly forward on a steady moving train. It glided down depressions and crested hills, white smoke issuing lariat-like from the funnel. But it was mostly committed to the straightness of the path, the single track, the good open way. And as an engine well-loved, the locomotive ran down the rails like a horse with a rider. Passengers sat mainly in silence, not taking one another for granted, but rather deeply respectful, for they were unacquainted, and there was not the familiarity of one type crossing another. From each could come the unseen, perhaps a strange resolve or stranger ability. Like athletes before a match, they had high mutual regard so that as the day passed from morning to noon, each man or woman kept to windows. Catherine, too, stared out the imperfect glass ahead at softly glowing grasslands, yellow seas of wheat, seas of wildflowers and June lilies, and at the dark mountains, which were always visible in one direction or another. Having neglected to get a book out of her luggage, she could only look and attempt thoughts and variations. At first, it was taking off her thin gold glasses and closing the good left eye so that she could blur the deep, permanent colors. This she did, but saw an old man staring at her, and at the way she tilted her head and set her mouth as if waiting for an answer she would never believe. She looked daft when she did that, or as if she had some kind of rare nerve dance. Back went the glasses, and for a while she stared straight and dignified, directly into the distance, this soon giving her the appearance of a gorgeous lunatic. She wore a white dress with high white shoes and an enormous wide-brimmed hat, which, although it glowed as fiercely as the face of a glacier, was modified in its absoluteness by the buttercup haze of a yellow saffron band. Her hair was a long, bright auburn tied back, and her eyes a striking green, as hazy as the saffron glow, and as cool as a spring in the mountains. And if it were not that way, the burn of freckles on her face might have consumed her, for they gave this girl a hot and sun-colored redness, even in the stillest of winters, and a youth that carried her well into age. The daughter of a Irish quarry worker and a Dublin Jewess, she was taken when small enough to be nicknamed Carity from the west of England to Boston, and then to Quincy, where her father became a foreman on a new opening in the granite quarry, and her mother took up work in a textile mill. Catherine herself went to normal school, escaping lovers because she was wedded to a dream landscape. And although many sought her, she was faithful to a vision of clouds and yellow sky off far off to the west in unsettled territories. She passed quickly from the society of the normal school to the company of a solitary idea. Convinced of new worlds, her existence was animated in such a way that she had no answers, not a one, but believed incessantly in what she imagined. She had read all her life of the openness of the West, of its red rivers and plains leafed in neutral and breathing gold, of the miraculous Indians and the Rockies, which were mountains of mist that formed and unformed dreams so fast as to confuse even the youngest of dreamers. And strangely enough, these substanceless dreams, these short electric pictures, these confused but royally intense sketches, gradually gave to her a strength, practicality, an understanding which many a substantial man would never have. Her vindication, almost God promised, was as clear as the excellent sea air or the deep blue pools which in summer formed at the bottom of the quarries to her father's chagrin. Her father, whose strength had equaled the beauty of her mother, had seen in her very early what he himself had lost. And unlike many fathers, he had no envy. He was too good for that. He loved her too much. He saw himself as a stone arch, unbending, sheltering around his wife and daughter to keep them safe and await the day when his daughter could soar on her visions and be settled. Catherine, a dreamer, was not hard, but tender. And when her parents died, one following the other in a general epidemic, she was wild. Just to be in Quincy, as gray as a man's suit, afflicted with ice and dark winds, a shabby collection of boards amidst scrub trees like the coat of a dying mare, made her sad in a way which does no good and leads to dead ends and contemptible unbelieving. One day, in winter, she thought she saw her father standing by her mother, who was gentle and strong and had been the first to die. Her father held a sledgehammer of the finest wood and with a shining gold head. He said, "I shall free you," and went to the base of the quarry where he smashed the cast iron braces and beams which held the rock. The iron rang like a thousand bells, and black pieces shattered over the quarry, ringing the pools and echoing off the high walls. And her father continued until every chain was severed, every brace broken, until all metal and all the past was smashed, buried in clear pools. Free air circulated away from its bounds, and the muscular father said to her, a little out of breath, but with as good a red color as he had had on the finest day of summer, he said, Catherine, my Carity, we too have had it with this place. We are not permanently rooted here, and you must go away. I have smashed these bonds, and this I did for you. Pile your hair, tie it firmly, and find a new place." This she did about a year later and headed west for there she sensed something which would give her the moment she wanted before her death, moments of full cognizance and dream vision, the red roses of her life and its humor. It was good to abandon Quincy and its quarry. She set her hat at an angle, trying to frame the light blue mountain ranges. The tracks threw up dust, and she eyed steam, the locomotive. These billowing clouds became captions for her thoughts, and they centered on yellow sky, on a dream quest which had spread to all the people. Yellow sky. It was still far off. That night they stopped in Gibson, a town spread across a large rise in the prairie where cattle roads, a flat, unnavigable river, and the railroad crossed at angles. Huge yards of seemingly spiderwork boards held cattle for boxcar loading, and during the whole of the late spring night, cattle filed past her window in the darkness, without awakening her assigned roommate, an elderly woman who looked like a tomb. Catherine stepped out of bed and went to the open window. A high wind carried occasional raindrops past the town and out into the vastly promising darkness from which an endless procession of moody steers were filing, giant animals intent upon moving to their slaughter, to feed the distant cities. She had seen the land seas of wheat and flowers, and from them came these steers, an abundance which kept her awake the rest of the night, wide-eyed, waiting for the hoofbeats and dust and drovers' calls to stop. But when morning found her, tears were in her eyes as she stared at the clouds of sparkling dust. From where did they come? Constantly, without even the slightest break. The land beyond was empty except for storm and mountains, and yet from there the night had been filled with a power so great it drew a shaking, tense silence, a joyous fright. The endless power was born somewhere out near yellow sky, and Catherine couldn't sleep because she was headed there. As surely and certainly as the warm steel track or the confident horseman who often appeared alongside to race the train. Leaving Gibson, they skirted the wide river and crossed a road on which thousands of cattle were backed up for miles. In the distance, they were as even at brown as the drovers' felt hats. For scores of miles, the landscape was the same, a rolling plain which looked like masses of brown whales, dotted flowers, banks of lilies and grasses. The train's exact and faithful forward motion led her to expect something ahead at all moments. And although there was nothing save the glittering May landscape, the convincing direction became in itself more than enough to hold her. And hold her it did, as had her realization of the night power in and around Gibson. She was held fast, but no more than anyone on the train, no more than farmers, fencemen, or drovers outside who were passed by and left to work amid their own silence and claim lands, no more than boys in Gibson who prodded cattle with dry white cotton willow sticks, or distant horsemen on a ridge galloping only to disappear, although leaving the surety of their gallop impressed upon the passengers. A detachment of pony soldiers, 75 blue, rode two by two on a wagon train, swords and buckles shining. They did not always know what they did, but by God they did it, as it was inevitable. Had she not lived her life in grayness and seen the bright only by fantasy? Did she not, as the daughter of a man, deserve these rich lands which had been declared ready and were being gathered in the arms of those who had come from such long ways away? Yellow sky was in the mountains, up high, beyond the timberland, which was like a skirt. The air was as thin as shell and pearl bright as the lakes and plummeting black rock streams. She would stop in Yellow Sky, but others would pass right on, and yet others right down to the broken beaches of the Pacific. This young, impressionable girl, alone on the cool wicker weave seat of a shady railroad car moving out west, could not be stopped. The colors in her were bound for Yellow Sky. At about 6 in the morning, the tired train halted in a cool saddle of the mountains just above the tree line. Men began to carry wood from enormous stockpiles along the track and load it in the coaler. A wooden trough was lowered from a cable-bound barrel tank, and mountain water fell into the blackened holds of the locomotive, dribbling, spraying, and steaming from valves of nickel and steel, hissing like a swarm of locusts in the convoluted boilers. The steam from the locomotive's gasket mingled with the early morning mist, low clouds, which hid white, gold-flecked mountains of sunrise. The peaks had begun to shine many hours before, and after sunset they would shine even though the night was black. The price for this advanced and delayed burnishings of the mountains being shade and darkness at the extreme hours. Those who lived in that place stared each day in special communication at the shining crowns all about them. The man who had charge of the railroad depot was tall, and wore hobnob boots which awakened passengers as he walked on top of the cars. His boots also awakened his children, a little barefaced boy and two fat little girls happy to have their own thousand of private jokes. The 100 or so people in the town were miners, bridge workers, and railroad men who rode small mounted donkey engines up and down the passes, securing faulted tracks and removing obstructions. There were always bridges to build, sometimes of several yards, sometimes of a quarter of a mile, because it was ravine country, rocky, high, indifferent to smooth trafficking men, and natural only to birds such as eagles, hawks, crows, and falcons, mountain birds with eyes of wondrous and staggering capabilities. Sharp as a 10-foot glass, they still could not see veins of silver spread variously throughout the ravines and deep into rock, where only men could go and by great effort. The trackers held the land down by use of iron bands. The bridgemen smoothed it, and the miners pierced it, as if they were hunters, and it a mammoth succumbing to their studied attack. The attack was not studied, but passionate, and not of greed alone. At each day's end, the bridgemen, the railroad men, the miners looked at the land. In the quiet time, when the mountains shone softly like lanterns into the dark valley, and they saw that it was not damaged, work as they did, the peaks were high, the streams excellently fresh, the pastures rich, their iron and wood, their fences and tracks all but invisible due to the greatness of the land. This, as much as anything else, made them love it. It was invincible, and so beckoned, challenging them to make their mark. Impossible, they said when they looked up, for the sky was as blue as a pure packet of indigo, and it reached into deep, unconquerable heaven. The conductor, who had warned Catherine to be careful of sparks, prompting her to say that it was impossible to be careful of sparks, roused her from a fitful, watery-eyed, straight-backed, sitting-up, night-never-end sleep, and she, with the rest of the passengers, stepped into a mountain village where they were served tea and tolls. Catherine stood quietly at yet another window, this in the depot, and she saw in the distance the lantern mountains, glowing gold in all directions, catching the future sun. There, and just then, did she realize was the source of the power she had sensed days before. This time, it was realization which struck her, not revelation. and there were no tears or ringings within. She simply realized in the deadest and most somber of moments that in those mountains was the source. Glancing off high lighted rock faces where no man could ever go, split into rivers eastward and westward, running in little lingers to every part of the land, to the oceans where it blended with the newly turned sea foam and sun. As the sun became stronger, but still not visible, they re-embarked onto the train, and when Catherine approached the three-stepped iron stand, the conductor offered her his hand. She wondered why, thinking that perhaps he was going to help her up. I mean, this was something he did not do. But he shook her hand and barred her way. "Why?" she said. And then he pointed to her luggage, leather cases and white canvas duffels. And when she still did not understand, to the mountains with golden light like the warm light from a candle, she was struck dumb. The train began to pull away, conductor and all, with a vast exhalation of white steam, and he said to the stunned girl, which she already knew, "This is Yellow Sky." As the train vanished, she could only think of her father, her mother, and the gray oceans in between. Oceans in between. Their lights had lasted, and she had found her way. It came in a flood, and she shuddered. Oceans in between. It was an end. It was a beginning. Catherine had come to Yellow Sky. Thank you.
Catherine Comes to Yellow Sky by Mark Helprin, read by Lisa Gay Hamilton. We know you like to listen to short stories, but if you can write them too, enter our annual Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Contest. This year's theme is Tales That Surprise. For more details on the contest, including the deadline and the prize, visit our website, selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Neas Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.